You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable, where we get you up to date on everything that made headlines around the region this past week, or at least we try to. Joining me on the panel today are Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News, Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press of Idaho, and Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on your side. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having us.
Hello.
Hello, hello, Kevin. Rebecca, I want to start with you with a public hearing that's taking place. Well, they're taking a break right now, but it's been going on since 8 a.m. at the State House. This is House Bill 249, and this is the bill to add work requirements and other restrictions to the voter-approved Medicaid expansion program.
Right. So it's been a busy morning over at the State House. So Representative John Vandervoorde from NAMPA presented this bill, and it would require people who fall in that gap population to be working or actively seeking work, or in some cases volunteering if they're able, in order to qualify for this program. And so there's been a lot of dozens of people have been testifying this morning. The vast majority have been in opposition of this bill, and the critics have been saying it could create a second gap population, that not everybody who is deemed qualified to work can actually work because life gets complicated. And then there has been, you know, there was one supporter, Fred Birnbaum from the Idaho Freedom Foundation, who just basically, he said that, like, this is needed to really rein in the Medicaid program so that people don't take advantage.
And they're taking a break right now, but testimony will resume at 1 p.m., correct?
Yes.
But now we have a whole idea of potentially a something breaking at 12:30, a news conference potentially about this, but we don't know for certain yet if that's happening, Mike?
Well, for sure that there is a press conference happening somewhere between 12 and 12:30, depending on when they get off the floor. They could be starting at any minute. But we don't know really what it's about. It's in the middle of the hearing on the piece of legislation. So it sounds like what they're doing is trying to get out in front of it. John Vandervoorde and Megan Blanksma, both representatives, are making an effort to answer some questions that they perceive are miscommunications or people who don't understand the legislation. They just want to try to get out in front of it and talk to media members kind of in the middle of the hearing. I think they probably, when they set it up, expected the hearing to be done and so they could answer these questions. But now they'll do their press conference and go back for the hearing.
And Rebecca, like you said, at least dozens of people testifying, and the vast majority they were opposed to this, right? Because this is not what 60% of the voting population voted in.
Right, 61%. People are saying that we want a clean bill. We voted for a clean bill. You are obligated to pass a clean bill. Now, the work requirements do carve out some exceptions. So if you are caring for a child under the age of 18, for instance, or you are giving care to somebody who's disabled in your family or whatnot, you can get exempted from these work requirements. But there was testimony from people like one woman who said that she lives in Boise, has breast cancer, and had incredible difficulty even holding down a job where she was working about 9 hours or so a week because she had to be able to get to her chemotherapy treatments. She never knew how severe her reaction would be. So she didn't know if she'd be out for hours vomiting or if she'd be, you know, basically just completely tanked and sleeping for 18 hours or if she'd be able to go right back to work. And she said, you know, she's privileged in that she's friends with the CEO of the company and they have been really accommodating to work with her.
But most people don't have that option.
But she pointed out most people do not have that option. Mm-hmm. And other people said, you know, if you live in a rural area, you might have to drive dozens of or hundreds of miles even to get to a job or to get to a volunteer opportunity. And if you're sick or don't have access to a car, it can be really hard to fill those requirements.
And then, Mike, I want to bring up what's going on with Senator C. Scott Grow. He's trying to make it harder to get a referendum on the ballot in the midst of all of this.
So you'll have to kick me under the table if I go too long on this because it's really fascinating to me. But it goes back, I mean, when I was covering this, the legislature back in the day and a few years in 2011, when the Luna laws passed, there were these three referendums that popped up on the ballot. They repealed that legislation. And soon after that, in 2013, there was an effort to make it so that instead of just getting 6% of the registered voters in Idaho, you now had to get 6% in 18 of the 35 counties.
That's right.
Or districts, legislative districts.
And that's what they did with Medicaid.
Right. And that's what they did with Medicaid, which is not an easy thing to do because you have to reach that 6% in 18 of the districts, which a lot of them are remote districts. They're hard. If you're in a rural district, knocking on doors and getting signatures isn't the easiest thing in the world. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to make sure that it wasn't just the city of Boise or large population areas kind of deciding the fate of these referendums. Well, now what he wants to do is make it so that 10% of the voting population needs to be signing off on referendums in 32 of the 35 districts. So that would make it considerably more difficult to get something on the ballot. Critics of this legislation are saying that this is purely a reaction to people taking things into their own hands like they did in November with Medicaid expansion. C. Scott Grow, the senator, is arguing that if somebody has the support, if an issue has the support of the voting population, it should not make it more difficult to get more signatures. However, people who work in that realm and try to get the signatures are saying, yeah, it's going to be more difficult. You have to go to more places and get more signatures. And there's always the possibility.
A lot less time, right, Mike?
What was that?
And you have a lot less time to get it done.
Exactly.
Under this bill.
Right.
So more signatures and less time.
Right.
Well, but what's crazy is that it's not just you're going from 6% to 10%. You're adding in
14 more of the legislative districts.
Right.
Right. So you
have
to pretty much
go impossible.
Right. You have to go everywhere to try to get these signatures. And so it's going to be really interesting to see what the debate is like. They're going to have a public hearing. And we spoke with advocates who helped get the Medicaid expansion on the ballot in the first place. And they're not happy about it because they failed the first time. Right. It took a lot of work to get this on the ballot in the first place, and to make it more difficult, there are legal arguments of why you would probably want to make it a pretty difficult thing to get something on the ballot. I understand that. But advocates and people who are looking to go around the legislature when they need to are arguing that this is just making it so that almost impossible to get something on the ballot. I mean, 10% of the registered voters in 32 of the 35 districts, I mean, that's about, what, half of a primary election. Like half of an off-year election. So that's not easy, and it's going to be interesting to see how the debate goes.
And it's one of those things, too, where if you take it out of the hands of the people, which what does that say when we want to take our government out of the hands of the people? So interesting conversation to be had about that. When do they think they'll have the hearing? Will it happen this session?
Yeah. I mean, the expectation, he presented the bill this session. The expectation is that there would be a public hearing this session. Wow. I mean, it's hard to say whether or not it's going to hit an agenda next week, but I imagine it probably will over the next 2 weeks.
So, Kevin, I want to bring you more into the conversation because a lot going on the education front as well, if there's not enough going on already.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So let's start with the immunization opt-in bill.
Well, this is immunization is an opt-out bill, and it's dead for the legislative session. What this bill would have done was it would have required public schools, private schools, even private child care providers to furnish parents with information about their rights to opt their kids out of immunizations. At the same time, those parents get information about the immunizations that the state recommends. That bill passed the House. It is not going to get a hearing in the Senate. The chairman of the Senate Health and Welfare Committee, Fred Martin, a Republican from Boise, he is adamant. I've spoken to him twice this week on this issue, and he firmly believes that the message the state should be sending to parents is that you should get your kids immunized. He is saying, look, I'm hearing from folks in the health care community. I'm hearing from school administrators, school nurses, and they're all telling me the same thing about this issue, and those are the folks I'm listening to. As you might expect, Representative Priscilla Giddings, the Republican from Whitebird, who is pushing for this opt-out bill, is very upset by this development on the Senate side and is saying that the chairman is abusing his authority by essentially vetoing her bill. This stuff happens every legislative session. This is the power of a committee chair. And depending on how you feel about a piece of legislation, a committee chair is either doing something wonderful by holding a bad bill or doing something terrible by holding an important and and valuable bill. So, you know, we have this happen every legislative session, but when it's a hot button issue like immunization, it gets a lot of attention.
All right. So the opt-in bill is the sex ed bill. And so I know.
Yeah,
both.
There we go.
Okay. All right. It's hard to keep all of this straight. That's why
there's
have
a lot of opting going
there's
on.
There's so
in
much opting.
Direction.
I know. Yes. Okay. So both Rebecca and Kevin, you've covered this. Kevin, just get us up. So explain what happened with this bill and what it's doing.
What it would do is it would require parents to opt their kids into sex education classes, sex education units in a health class, for example. If a parent does not expressly give a child's permission for a child to take a sex education class, that child cannot take a sex education class. That bill passed on Wednesday on a party line vote on the House floor. It now goes to the Senate. It's a little bit too early to tell exactly what will happen with it on the Senate on the Senate side.
So to explain this, and I have personal experience because I just got an email the other day because I have a fifth grader and got a note saying that they will be teaching sex education to the students. If we do not want our student to be in there, we had to reply back to the email saying
right.
that
they
would
the
not.
Exactly. That's what the law is right now. Parents can opt their kids out of sex education. That's how the law works now. This bill, if it became law, would basically turn that on its head and mm-hmm. would be opt-in instead of opt-out.
Right. So if you didn't respond to an email like that, that's basically opting your child out of it.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would have that effect.
So what is the what is the feeling of this then, even though since the Senate still has to vote on this, what is the climate around that?
You know, I really don't know what the climate is on the Senate side yet, because like I say, it just did pass on Wednesday, and I have not had a chance to get a feel for what may happen with it on the Senate side. It would still have to go through another public hearing presumably in the Senate Education Committee. Nothing scheduled yet, but I really would not have expected it to be scheduled quite yet. We'll watch the calendars to see if it comes up, because if it's going to move on the Senate side, it's going to have to move fairly quickly. We think heading into the final couple of weeks of the legislative session.
We're hoping. Yeah.
You know, I'll always say that with kind of a hopeful swing in my voice.
I know, right?
Yes,
exactly.
For this to move, it would have to move reasonably quickly on the Senate side.
Rebecca, you talked about this before on the program with the transgender inmate at the Idaho State Prison, and there's been some movement on that case.
Right. So the state had asked the federal judge to put a stay on it, basically put that ruling on hold while they appeal to the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Earlier this week, the judge said basically, no, I'm not going to put it on hold. I've already considered the issues. I believe that this Edmo is at risk of great serious harm, physical harm, if she isn't provided the gender confirmation surgery by the state. And so you need to get a move on, basically. They have until, I think, June 13th, rather, to provide her with the surgery.
So where does the case go from here then? Is it finished, or is there more to it?
Well, the appeal is still in progress
right.
at the Ninth Circuit. And so certainly that's in progress. But there's a lot of deadlines there. I mean, the state has until March 6th to, I think, file one of their briefs they need to file on the appeal. And then the plaintiffs will have time to respond or, I guess, an appeal.
But even though all of this is going on, so what people should understand is this federal judge said, as all of this is still moving forward in the court system, there will be no stay. You have to get this gender reassignment surgery done for this inmate.
Right. And so I think with the case, even if they went ahead and did that gender reassignment surgery for the inmate now, there's still all of the questions of whether the state is obligated to provide those surgeries as a general rule. Right. And so my guess is that the case would, I think, go forward and not be considered moot at that time. But certainly for Ms. Edmo, at least some of her concerns would presumably be resolved at that point because she would have received surgery. Also, the state could just opt to not obey the order, which we've seen that happen in some other cases on different issues involving prisons where a party says they just don't do what the judge tells them to do, and then they can be held in contempt. So.
And that's a whole other issue when that happens. We are continuing our Friday Reporter Roundtable. My panel today includes Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press of Idaho, Mike Sharp with KIVI, Six on Your Side, and Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News. He's joining us by phone from the State House. And in the beginning of our Reporter Roundtable, we talked about the hearing that was going on today regarding adding work requirements to the Medicaid expansion bill. And we mentioned that there was a news conference that was slated. And our Jimmy Dawson is down covering the news conference, but since he's actually at the news conference, we can't talk to him. But Mike Sharp, you have one of your reporters down there as well, and you've been able to communicate with her. So get us updated.
Yeah, so Jessica Taylor just had a conversation with Representative John Vanderwoude, who we talked about is the sponsor of the legislation, who said that they are not going to have a vote on the sideboards bill today. Of course, they're saying this is a pretty typical thing because of the length of the testimony and expecting the testimony to continue into the afternoon. So they are not expecting to have a vote today.
But they will continue with the testimony this afternoon.
Correct.
So that's where we're at with that. So, Rebecca, there was a large case that the Idaho Supreme Court made a decision on, and it was known as the Verity case. So quickly take us through what that case was and what has happened.
Right. So this has been closely watched by a lot of news organizations in the state for reasons you'll soon see. But basically, it was a lawsuit brought by a former teacher named James Verity against USA Today, KTVB, a television station in Portland called KGW, and then a couple of others in the news industry after they reported on the results of a national investigation into teacher licensing. And what that investigation found was that teachers who had a license revoked in one state were often able to move to another state and get licenses there. Such was the case with Mr. Verity. He had his teaching license revoked in Oregon and then later moved to Idaho. And Idaho officials did know that his license had been revoked and after, you know, decided to give him an license here. And then he was actually working for a school district in Idaho when this story broke. And because of that, he left his job and it's was, you know, obviously stressful for him.
Mm-hmm.
So he said basically that these news organizations basically committed defamation by inference, by inferring bad things about him.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was because he said that what his license had been revoked for was because he was found to have inappropriate sexual contact with a student who was 18 years old when his license was revoked in Oregon. And when he came to Idaho, he said, you know, that when he applied for a license here, they knew about it. It was discussed. There was, you know, there was testimony by people who said that, like, he's fine to work with kids now. This is not an issue. And so he was given a license here and began working. But he said that some of the news organizations, like, implied that the sexual contact with the 18-year-old student was actually with a minor or that it was illegal sexual contact as opposed to inappropriate sexual contact. So there were a lot of these sort of shades of gray that he said because that some of these organizations sort of implied that things were worse than the facts of the case. Yeah. So the Idaho Supreme Court issued a ruling, and they said basically USA Today and KTVB Television in Boise did nothing wrong. They reported accurately. They reported they did not commit defamation by inference. However, the Supreme Court also said defamation by inference exists in Idaho, which is a new thing. So truth has always been the absolute defense to libel or defamation, right? So if I report something about someone, even if that puts them in a bad light.
If it's the truth.
And so I'm allowed to report it. This new standard basically says if I report something about someone and a listener or a reader or a viewer decides, like, infers something worse about that person than what I actually said, maybe, that person can then sue. They have standing to sue in court for defamation by inference.
And I think it's important to note that you could go to literally any news outlet and look at the stories they're posting on Facebook and look at what people are inferring about those stories. There isn't one story that's posted by any news outlet that isn't incorrectly inferred by somebody who's reading it. So, I mean, it's a chilling effect. And I think there's no secret that a lot of times people who work for media outlets like to talk about things that affect people who work for media outlets, right? Like, that's a joke. But this is a legitimately concerning thing. And that's why so many, as you mentioned, Rebecca, so many news outlets were working together and watching this so closely.
Well, go ahead, Kevin.
And another fairly important piece of this ruling is that the Supreme Court said that for libel purposes, for defamation purposes, that they can't imagine a scenario where a teacher would be considered a public official. That's fairly significant, and that's not the case in every state. And what that means in terms of libel is that a teacher would have a significantly lower standard, a lower burden of proof in a libel case.
And that is one part that is fascinating because – yes, a teacher, they're saying, cannot be a public figure, yet this teacher was also a football coach. There is a public part of the position that he held, or at least that could be argued, but there's just so many nuances to this.
Right, and he mentioned something that I think for those who don't spend all their time talking about libel laws, that distinction is very important because, as Kevin mentioned, the legal work that it takes to prove defamation or libel for somebody who is not a public figure is considerably lower than if you are considered a public figure. Public figures, it's really difficult to prove libel, and it involves actual malice and a lot of other legal terms. This would make it much easier if you're in that position and possibly a public figure, considering what we're talking about now, to not legally be considered as such.
Right. And so he was a high school girls athletic coach. I'm not sure if football was among the sports that he coached or not.
I think it was basketball.
Oh, was it basketball? Sorry. I knew he had just taken a coaching position, correct, when they started reporting on this story. So my apologies.
Oh, that's right. No, I think you're right. I was thinking of the Oregon
coaching position. But here in Idaho, yeah.
Gotcha.
And this is a real thing. I mean, this can happen in stories that we cover. I mean, we have a story out of Fruitland with involving a principal and basketball coach who is facing misdemeanor charges. I mean, you know, we do occasionally have to write about educators who are in trouble with the law. And, you know, how a teacher or a principal or a coach is viewed in terms of whether they're a public official or a public figure is really significant in terms of libel law.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so the case is actually still going forward against
KGW
in Portland. And part of what the Supreme Court said was basically their broadcast was vaguer on some of these charges. They didn't go into as much detail about exactly or not charges, rather. I mean, I don't mean that in a legal sense. I mean that in the
Well, to be clear, like when KTVB is reporting,
right,
they were very clear in their reporting that he had told his employer was aware of the inappropriate relationship and that they said this was inappropriate. It was not illegal. They made those very clear distinctions in their reporting. The Supreme Court in Idaho said KGW did not.
Well, but they did in some cases. They did in, like, say, online version. Their online version was different than a broadcast version. And people who watch a lot of news or read a lot of news know often how there's a promo on a front page of a newspaper to a longer story later in. Or you might hear a TV blurb promoing a news story later on.
So did you just read the headline and then not read the story?
Or for more information, go to our website, that sort of thing. So it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how this actually falls out in real life. Like, do we now have to have every radio news segment be longer than a minute because
we don't want
to
infer
detail
anything.
Everything so deeply? It's hard to say.
Mm-hmm. I want to end on a completely different note. I want to talk about some good news and some positive news. And Mike, a story that you guys recently did about a kidney donation.
Yeah, it's a really cool story. I think one of the coolest stories we've done in the last couple of weeks is it's the Villanueva family in Nampa. Javier, the father of the family, had an illness. His kidney was failing, and they waited for 4 years to get a kidney transplant. And the family members tried to donate their kidneys, but because of a rare blood disorder, he wasn't available or he wasn't eligible to take their kidney. And so what they did is they did some research into it's called the kidney pair exchange. And so the mother, Michelle, the wife of Javier, decided to donate a kidney to a stranger in order to move Javier up the list. And pretty much what they ended up doing was swapping kidneys with this other family that was in a similar situation. They ended up doing the procedures three doors down from each other in the same hospital.
Wow.
And swapping these kidneys, the Villanuevas are recovering and doing better. And now these teenage boys that are children of Michelle and Javier, they are getting in line to now donate as living donors their own kidney to complete strangers. So this family has decided, because of their experience waiting so long to try to get a kidney to save their father and husband, that now they are just going to try to help a family in need for no other reason than just trying to help out.
Wow.
It's just a really cool story and an inspiration to anybody who's been through watching a family member who was in need of a procedure like that.
It is always nice to end on good news and to know there are good people in the world, right? I want to thank all of you for coming in today. I love our reporter roundtable. I thank you guys for taking time out of your day every week, especially during this busy legislative session. My reporter roundtable today, Mike Sharp with KIVI 6 on your side, Kevin Richard with Idaho Education News, and Rebecca Boone with the Associated Press of Idaho. Thanks again, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.